Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 18th. This week we feature an interview with David Nassau, the author of The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. The interview was conducted by Kevin Spinelli as part of our new Catholic Book Club, where we'll be sponsoring discussions about the books we choose each month. Kevin, a Jesuit scholastic who teaches at Boston College, spoke to Professor Nassau at his office here in New York.
First couple of points. Patriarch. It's a term for me that implies family. It also has a biblical notion to it. I think Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were strong leaders, strong fathers. The title itself is used only five times, I counted, in the book, Patriarch, especially toward the end. When Joseph Kennedy is setting up for his family to take a picture the morning after the election, and then when he's saying to his boys, you're going to have Bobby Kennedy as your AG, and you're not going to overrule me. Why did you pick this for the title, Patriarch? What was in your mind?
I used the Patriarch as a title, one, because it connotes strength. Two, because it connotes a mutuality of respect. The patriarch is not a tyrant. The patriarch is not a dictator. The patriarch is the leader of a family, of a tribe, and is recognized as such and respected as such by those who follow him. And there is a kind of biblical resonance that appealed to me in the term patriarch. In the end, although this is the biography not of a family, but of an individual, I came to acknowledge, to respect, and to agree with what Joseph P. Kennedy always said about himself, that was what was most important to him was his role as father and the nurturing and preparation of his children for lives in public service. And to use the title Patriarch sort of brought the book back to that role, to Kennedy as father.
There's another term that is used a few times in the book, an allusion to classical literature, Cassandra, who is she was brought home with Agamemnon and basically prophesied ruin. I want to ask a question. I'm a Jesuit, and they send me far too much school, so I think these things. In Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, in the first book, he talks about happiness and the nature of happiness. And he offers the example of King Priam, who was the king of Troy, father of Hector. And Aristotle asks, was Priam happy? We look at Priam's life in full from beginning to end. And at the end of Priam's life, he was miserable. I kept thinking about that allusion when I was reading your book, because the end of Joseph Kennedy's life is miserable. I mean, it's almost breathtaking. Was he a happy man?
God, what a wonderful question. And a difficult question. Yes, I think so. I think certainly until the death of Joe Jr., there was a contentment that permeated his consciousness, the best way I can put it. And that contentment came from the sense that he had accomplished much of what he had set out to do. His own political career was in shambles, and he knew that. He knew he wasn't going anywhere after he came back. But that was a detour for him from his ultimate goal, which was to establish his children firmly in the American mainstream as Irish Catholics. He had hoped, I think, when he was at Harvard, that he would be able to do that. He was a Harvard graduate. He dressed like a banker. He talked like a banker. He was extraordinarily charming. He went out of his way to sidestep or to make it impossible to plant Irish cliches on his head. He didn't sing Sweet Adelaide. He didn't go to wakes. He didn't drink. He didn't talk about the old country. He didn't use slang the way his father-in-law, Honey Fitz, used slang. He was a gentleman. And there were many models for one to be an Irish Catholic, a gentleman, and an American. But it didn't take for him. It didn't take for him because the world, the country wasn't ready for it. But his children would inherit the world that he couldn't. And I think up to the death of Joe Jr., he never looked back. I mean, that was going to happen. And that sort of contentment, he was unhappy in the short run because this and this and this and this got in his way. But for the long haul, he knew that he had prepared his children, trained them, and given them huge trust funds that would enable them to be Irish Catholic Americans to the fullest extent possible without skimping on their Americanness, on their Irish heritage, or on their Catholic faith.
So he's content.
He's content, yeah. And I think that defines a certain kind of happiness. I think it did for him. And then after the death of Joe Jr. in 1944, there is a residue of mourning, of sadness, that he could never put away. But he learned to move on.
I just want to talk a little bit about his early life. As you said, he grew up, he was a gentleman. And I didn't realize how much money he actually had growing up, how fortunate he was as an Irish American in Boston at the end of the 19th century. His father was a powerful figure, a banker. And he was quite fortunate and in a different way than, you know, Honey Fitz and all that. So 1928, he's 40 years old, right? It's the same year this book club started, 1928, at American Magazine, The fall of 1928, you write your book that at age 40, he started to turn his focus from making money to preserving his wealth. Could you tell me, because I'm not that technically minded, but how did he make so much money and how much money did he actually have when he was 40 years old?
He had somewhere between tens and hundreds of millions. I think he had in the high two figures, or millions in the high two figures. He made his money by going to Hollywood, demanding to be paid in stock options, manipulating those stock options through insider trading. He refined insider trading in a way that nobody had ever done it. He would spread rumors. He would send out telegrams. He would manipulate stock prices, pushing them up when he wanted to sell long, pushing them down when he wanted to sell short. And by the time he left Hollywood, he had this basket full of options that he began to discharge at the height of the market. And that made him, you know, tens of millions of dollars. I had access to his business records and his stock selling sheets, his transactions, so I could follow it. And it's breathtaking the way he turns over these options and makes money. Breathtaking. He didn't give a damn about the movies as a form of entertainment, as a form of enlightenment, as a form of education. They were him a vehicle to make money. And what makes sense when you look at it in the long run is that it was a vehicle that he sought out because the dominant players in banking and finance, certainly in Boston, the Yankees, the Brahmins, the Protestants, wanted nothing to do with an immigrant commercial form. Nothing. So it was the Jews, you know, and a handful of Irish Catholics who made their way and made their success.
And part of how he marketed himself was as a alternative to Jewish producers' studios. What was the term he kept using? There were a bunch of haberdashers or clothiers or tailors.
Yeah, well, he didn't. He was. People used that about him. They always said, you know, he didn't sell furs. He played ethnic politics as well as anybody. It was part of his blood. He knew how to do it. And he knew that once he got to the West Coast, in the West Coast, in Boston, it's the Brahmins versus the Irish Catholics. On the West Coast, it was the Jews versus the Christians. So he went from being the outsider to being the insider group, capitalized on it brilliantly. He went to Mass every Sunday when he was in Hollywood. But he played up not the fact that he was an Irish Catholic, but that he wasn't a Jew. He was an all-American. He was a banker. He was he was American-born and bred of American-born and bred parents. He could be trusted as such in a way that the Jews could not. And he didn't say Jews are untrustworthy. He says the rest of the country thinks Jews are untrustworthy. Therefore, Hollywood is going to be susceptible to censorship campaigns, to all sorts of attacks all over the country because nobody trusts the Jews. They trust me. They don't trust the Jews.
Just trying to think about how he made his money. There's a very interesting page toward the beginning of the book where you cite two letters from Boston Irish women when Kennedy sells his Pathé, is that how you pronounce the studio or the company? Basically, his own assets in the company retain their value while stockholders, you know, these poor women from Brighton, and I forget where the other one is from, take a bath, and they write Joe Kennedy letters, and it's, you know, it's fantastic. Knowing your father, the late P.J. Kennedy and Honey Fitz, I put my money into your enterprise only to see you where you are willing or trying to pass it over to another concern for about nothing. This hardly seems Christian-like. What do you think Joe Kennedy thought about people he beat in, you know, business deals? Did he say to himself, you know, hey, if these people are dumb enough to get swindled, then they deserve it?
Yeah.
Or did he just, he was completely indifferent to it, or did it sting him?
He trusted no one. No one. Business was war. As long as you stayed legal, you could do whatever you wanted. And if the ladies in Brighton who bought Pathé stock were stupid enough to do it, if Gloria Swanson was stupid enough to entrust, to sign documents he put before her, you know, that was her problem.
Right.
Everyone should have had access to lawyers. He couldn't be responsible for anyone other than himself and his family. Period. End of story. He didn't trust anybody. He didn't trust the Irish Catholics in Boston.
Right.
Because they had played fast and loose with his father's political campaign.
Right, yeah.
He didn't trust the politicians, the businessmen, the Wall Street operators. He held his own counsel. He surrounded himself with a bunch of smart, smart people who were loyal to him, most of whom were from Boston and Irish Catholic. But he didn't entirely trust them either.
Yeah.
That was the source of his financial strength, that his goal, his end, was to build million-dollar trust funds for his children. And any means to that end was appropriate.
And he worked like a dog. And I guess that's what drove him. I don't see any other thing that drew him so much. It just seemed that he was driven to make money for his family. Part of it was pride, but make sure everybody is safe. Is that...
Yeah, I think that's it exactly. You know, he never had any commitment. In, I think it's in the early 50s, Fortune magazine does a survey of the richest people in the country, and he's in the top 15. But he's the only one who's not associated with any particular industry, because everything is a means to an end. Right. He's not building a business. He's not building a corporation. He's not building an industry. He's building a nest egg that he can then distribute among his children.
And it seems evident in the way he only held jobs for a couple of... I mean, it's unbelievable. 15 months here, 6 months here, a year, 2 years, 2.5 years here, even the ambassadorship. He never became entwined with anything.
No, he squeezes. He's not committed, again, to any industry, to any company. He uses up opportunities. He squeezes everything he can out of them. And he puts everything he has into them. And then in twin exhaustion, he's exhausted. And he's exhausted the opportunity. It's time to move on.
Yeah,
his work schedule is bizarre. I mean, he will work 100 hours a week until near collapse, and then he'll go on his vacations. His vacations, he would never interrupt his winter vacation to Palm Beach, because he knew he needed that rest and rehabilitation so that he could plunge back into these 100-hour work marathons.
Yeah, there's no sentimentality in him toward anything he's doing. And you mentioned the sort of work holidays. And one other thing that came up, and maybe we could talk about this later in family, because I want to get to FDR for a bit. But it just was odd, the setup that he and Rose had. You know, you at one point you said, in their relationship, they only saw each other for about 60 days a year. And they would often vacation without one another. And that was okay, because Joe worked really hard and he needed his rest. It's just an odd relationship.
It's an odd relationship, but it's also not unique. It's a marriage, you know, it's close to an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
They marry very young, and the deal that's made is that Joe is going to provide for this family, that Rose will never be wanting, and that Rose will never be embarrassed. He will lead his own life. That life is going to include lots of other women. But he's not going to shove it in her face the way that Honey Fitz, Rose's father,
Toodles,
yeah, gets involved in this scandal that embarrasses the entire family.
Yeah.
So Joe is not going to do that. And I think Rose, she respects that. She's grateful. He allows her to deny what is obvious to everyone else, that he has a life filled with other women.
Sometimes, you know, even when he was in his 20s, I guess this started, and I don't want to keep going on this, but it's like, I was wondering, where did he get this from? Where did this lifestyle, granted Honey Fitz had some relationships with women other than his wife, But his father certainly wasn't somebody who seemed to be unfaithful or, you know, live a playboy lifestyle or something. Where did this arise? Was it just what was happening in his milieu from guys from Harvard were doing this? It was just, you know, make that much money? I mean,
yeah, I think this was as you move into as you move in the circles that he moved in, I think that the brokers, the bankers, the go-getters in his social milieu, certainly once he goes out to Hollywood, everybody's fooling around. Yeah. And in Wall Street, and the bankers. I mean, the wife, your wife is the mother of your children. She's not your companion. Yeah. She's not necessarily even your love interest.
I think one love of his life, and I learned so much about FDR, one love that Joe Kennedy had was FDR. Why? Why did he love him so much?
FDR was the president. FDR was the only man Kennedy ever met who was more charming, more manipulative than he was. He wanted desperately to be part of the insider circle. Kennedy's the outsider who wants to be an insider. And Roosevelt is the ultimate insider. I mean, Roosevelt has everything except mobility, except his legs. And there is a self-confidence that Roosevelt has that's even greater than that of Kennedy.
Was he smarter than Joe Kennedy?
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
I think he was. Politically, he was smarter. Yeah. He was always three steps ahead. Kennedy never could look past the day after tomorrow. Roosevelt could, because as a politician, there was always an election coming down. So he would always look 3 years in advance, 4 years in advance, 8 years in advance. And he had to. He had to take a long view on the economy. He had to take a long view on relationships with Europe in the 30s and into the war. And Kennedy may have admired that as well. But with Roosevelt came the White House, and for Joe Kennedy, you know, to be invited regularly to the White House, to have informal dinners in the, you know, luncheons in the Rose Garden, to be photographed and questioned by reporters as he left, you know, there was nothing like it.
I've grown absolute respect for FDR's political savvy. As you said, Kennedy would manipulate people. FDR was better and manipulated Joseph Kennedy. I want to go to a quote by Lord Halifax and talk a little bit about the British. This is after Joe dies. And Halifax is writing about, I think, a dinner or something they had. And Halifax recalled that Kennedy was in his usually unsatisfactory mood, pessimistic. I really do not begin to know what he thinks or wants. And then you write, Halifax recalled, seemed to be a compound of surviving and quite futile feeling that America ought never to have gotten into the war, and unhappiness at the consequences of the war, and people like himself who used to have a lot of money. Halifax had little sympathy with Kennedy, having lost one son in Europe and a second return from combat in Africa with both legs amputated. On the contrary, he was rather disgusted. I am afraid, he concluded in his diary, I think he is a rotten fellow.
Yeah.
That quote shook me because basically Halifax is saying, well, everybody loses. Everybody's lost in this war. There's no reason, you have no right to behave this way, so dour. But I kept thinking to myself, it was in London in 39... especially before Joe was killed, that's when he seems to turn. Before, he seemed charming with FDR, and then he gets 6 months into the ambassadorship is when I see his sort of tone of things change. And he sort of becomes a rotten fellow before Rosemary, the operation before Joe's death, before Kathleen. Do you agree with that, or can you offer
what Halifax is saying is that nation, civilization, comes first and the individual comes second, that you have to have a higher goal. You have to have this a higher entity. And for Halifax, it's, you know, Britain. It's British civilization. It's, you know, queen and country. And he comes to the conclusion that Kennedy cares only for himself, that Kennedy accounts the war a failure because he's lost a son. And he cannot look beyond that. Kennedy is also not a Brit with a stiff upper lip. I mean, one of the joys of writing about Kennedy is, you see, he doesn't cry in public, but he cries.
Yeah.
He mourns. He doesn't, you know, Halifax, when there's a loss, goes to work the next day. Mm. He puts his hat on, he puts his suit on, and he makes believe nothing has happened. Kennedy literally falls apart.
Yeah.
There's a warmth, there's a vitality to Kennedy that the British never get. There's an ability to speak his mind, which the British never get. And Kennedy's inability to play by the rules, to play for the team, does not sit well with any of the British, certainly not with Halifax.
And they don't like him by the time he is recalled as ambassador, the Brits.
They can't stand the man. They can absolutely not stand the man because he's at cross purposes. It's very clear what's going on. It's very clear that the British know they're going into a war with Germany, and the British know that the only way they can possibly hold their own is with American help. They don't say that, but they know that, and everybody knows that, and the Americans know it. And Kennedy wants more than anything else to keep the Americans out. He doesn't want the Americans in the beginning to even supply, to give assistance to the British. He doesn't want American fortune, and certainly not American lives, to be sacrificed.
Because they're going to lose.
To keep the British Empire afloat for 2 years or 3 years until, you know, the Germans take over. And He distrusts, he detests Churchill.
Yeah.
Churchill is for him the ultimate prevaricator.
He's like a British Honey Fitz too.
Yeah, but there's something for Kennedy profoundly immoral about Churchill. He's convinced that Churchill will sacrifice one half the British population if that's what it takes to get the Americans in, and that no loss of life or loss of fortune is too great to maintain the Queen and the Empire. And for Kennedy, that's profoundly wrong. You can't sacrifice lives and fortune for some abstract entity, you know, which is Great Britain.
And throughout his ambassadorship, he keeps saying here and there, I mean, there's these speeches he gives around Britain that he gets in trouble for. But he keeps basically saying that, how could you ask your children to fight in this war?
Look, he says the same things during the Cold War. He's not a pacifist. I mean, he's not against all wars at all times. But he believes that war and military action doesn't solve very much, doesn't solve anything. And that there is something profoundly ill-founded in the assumption that if we just keep battling, keep fighting, if the war takes 1 year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, we can never give in. We can never surrender. Can't abide that thought.
And ironically, he gets his children into pretty frontline situations in the war, and, you know, Jack is missing for a couple of weeks, and then Joe dies. Kathleen Kick's husband also dies. And it's almost ironic. Here's the guy who was so adamant against the war even beginning, and then, you know, loses his eldest son, which, as you said, crushes him, absolutely crushes him. And then what he thinks, you know, well, perhaps it does, cripple Jack. There's a profound irony there.
It's, for him, his worst, and he says this to some of his friends, he says, you know, how could this have happened? He said, I knew, you know, no one was as opposed to the war as I was. And he said, and now I see why. You know, one of the, if ever a movie is made or some visual representation of this, I hope that the filmmaker focuses on the meeting between Churchill and Kennedy at Hialeah, where Churchill has been defeated. As soon as the war is over, the British electorate throws Churchill out. They want a single-minded leader in war, but they want someone with a larger vision in peace. So Churchill comes to this country where he's lionized, and he meets Kennedy at Hialeah. Someone brings Churchill over, and Churchill says, I'm sorry for your loss. And Kennedy goes after him. He says, what do we gain?
Yeah.
And for Churchill, it's clear there is still a Britain, there is still a queen, there is still a European commons. But for Kennedy, there is no Joe Jr.
I'm going to end with the family a bit. So, but I can't not ask you about the church and Kennedy. First of all, I was surprised to learn about a guy I have never heard of. And in your book, he is cited more times in the index than Richard Cardinal Cushing. And his name was Enrico Galeazzi. Who was this man who I've never, ever heard of, and who Kennedy corresponded almost obsessively during, especially the 1960 campaign? Who is this guy?
Galeazzi is this extraordinary man. He's a papal power broker, I guess is the best way to... He is a layperson who becomes secretary to Pius, to, what is Pius, Cardinal...
Eugenio Pacelli.
Pacelli. He becomes his personal secretary. He remains close to him when he becomes pope. He knows everybody in the Vatican. He knows where the money is, where it's coming from, where it's going. He is privy to all the politicking that goes on when cardinals are chosen. He understands the way the Vatican works, and he understands it the way a ward leader understands the bigger picture. He's also a good man. He's a devout man. He's a pious man. He cares for his own children and his own family. Kennedy is always trying to pay him back by giving him Coca-Cola distributorships in Brazil or something. You know? And Galeazzi says no.
Because he's not making much money,
I'm content.
Right?
He's not making much money. And he is very close to Spellman. Galeazzi. And what's interesting about Kennedy is Kennedy can't wear his heart on his sleeve. The only way he can open himself up and unburden himself is to friends on the other side of the Atlantic who he's not going to come into touch with on a regular basis. So it's Beaverbrook, it's Galeazzi, it's, you know, a couple of others. And to Galeazzi, he writes these extraordinary letters. They were a godsend. The reason why I could write this book and no one until now had been able to write a book about Joseph P. Kennedy was that I had these letters, and I had the Beaverbrook letters. Galeazzi is a good man, and he opens all sorts of doors to the Vatican. And he helps establish Kennedy as the liaison in many ways between the Vatican and Washington. There's no official ambassador. Washington is wary of any official ties with the Vatican. But they need someone who can, certainly in the 50s, when the Vatican is a key player in politics, and Kennedy and Galeazzi become those liaisons.
Who had the letters between Galeazzi and Kennedy?
Kennedy kept every one of them.
Why? Why did he keep all these letters?
I think that's what people did.
Yeah.
I don't know that he even thought about it. I think he may have thought that at some moment in his life he would write his own autobiography.
In 1948, there's a... No, excuse me, 1947, there's an editorial in America Magazine about Joe Kennedy, basically denouncing him because Joe Kennedy was against the Truman aid to Europe, especially Greece and Turkey. And basically, in the editorial, it says, Joe Kennedy and others like him have blood on his hands, or their hands, because they're not concerned with Europeans or folks from other parts of the world, Asia, any place where there's a communist threat. And it seems to be a rift grows between, not necessarily America Magazine, but the hierarchy and Joe Kennedy. Everyone but Cushing seems to look a bit hesitantly, cautiously on Jack Kennedy. And you offer, especially going up to the 1960 election for president, you offer an interview from Cardinal Cushing with a fascinating list of reasons why Jack Kennedy was rejected by the hierarchy, something that Joe Kennedy recognized when it was happening, because he was aghast the morning of the election, the morning after the election, that it was so close, and it was because of anti-Catholicism. What is your sense? Why did the hierarchy reject Jack Kennedy as the Catholic candidate?
Joseph Kennedy, it was in many ways, you know, this is the earlier question about happiness and unhappiness. One of the things that disturbed Joe, and in his life he gets angry about a lot. You know, he's an angry man. But he is never as angry at any individual or institution as he is at the church. His bedrock, his institution, his home. In 1960, he believes that the church has to support a Catholic presidential nominee, that it's good for Catholics everywhere, and therefore it's good for the church. If a Catholic breaks through this political barrier, that it will be a signal unlike any others. And he talks all his life about Jewish solidarity, about how the Jews speak with one voice, how the Jews get their way, how the Jews organize politically, which happens later with the church, but certainly not in 1960. In 1960, it's a different world. In 1960, the Catholic Church stays as far away from politics as it can. It's scared to death. Right. It doesn't organize from the pulpit. It doesn't organize on any issue, not even on parochial schools. It sort of holds back. When it becomes clear that the church, the Catholic Church, that the Catholic Church hierarchy in this country, and that the leadership in the Vatican doesn't want Jack Kennedy to be president, Joe never gets over that betrayal. Now, why doesn't the church, if one can speak of a monolith, which I know is incorrect, but why is there no support for Jack Kennedy? One, he's not anti-communist enough, and his father hadn't been. He's not going to roll back communism in East Europe and protect the Catholic Church. Two, a Catholic president can't push for the two major items, and this is remarkable. 1960, the two major items on the church agenda were an ambassador to the Vatican, full diplomatic relations, and aid to parochial schools. And on neither of those issues, the church believes, can a Catholic president push hard. And I think the most important thing is that Cardinal Spellman wants to be the face of the church. And the fact that a handsome young man is going to be the most...
Harvard educated,
right. Boston Latin Harvard educated, is going to be the most visible Catholic in the country. It's just, that can't happen.
There's another critique, and you refer to America Magazine on page 722 of your book in the text. In the election, America thought Kennedy was, Jack Kennedy, was weak in the way that he talked about his own Catholicism and the way he separated. And you paraphrase, accused Senator America Magazine, a Jesuit journal, accused Senator Kennedy of pandering to bigots by discounting the influence of his religion on his beliefs and decisions and compartmentalizing his faith as a private matter. And that is the reality for Catholic political candidates now. It's fascinating that, he's attacked on both sides. He's not courageously Catholic enough as president.
Yeah. He does... there are a number of books the historians have written now. There's one called Try Faith or something about what happens in the 1950s in this country, how religion gets pushed into a new realm, being a private matter, whether you're a Protestant, a Jew, or a Catholic. And that's supposed to be the basis for this reconciliation of the faiths into a new America. Will Herberg most famously pushes this sort of Saturday Evening Post ecumenicalism. And Kennedy gives this remarkable speech in which he says, the Pope doesn't speak for me, I don't speak for the Pope. The Church doesn't speak for me, I don't speak for the Church. I'm a Catholic, I'm proud to be a Catholic. But that's a matter of conscience, of private. It's not going to inform my political decisions. The Constitution comes first, the Church comes second. And he has to say that politically, and he believes it. He believes it. He thinks when he gives this interview, I think in Look magazine, and then he gives a couple of speeches, that this is the end of the issue. He's made it clear. This is not going to come up anymore. And he is viciously attacked by church publications.
Yeah,
from top to bottom.
Roman, I was surprised. I mean, right up in the run-up to the actual general election, there's a piece on how Catholic politicians have to function in obedience, in strong relationship with the church. You bring up something I never knew about some election in Puerto Rico.
In Puerto Rico.
The denunciation of a candidate because he wasn't Catholic enough.
Yeah.
A whole party was sort of pushed away. That's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Because it's still an issue now. I mean, does a Catholic candidate who rejects Catholic teaching, should he be a Catholic?
Yeah.
Should he receive communion?
I'm trying to think of the... Kennedy understood what was going on with the church. His father didn't.
Yeah.
His father never, ever, ever did. And Spellman's not invited to the inauguration.
The last chapter of the book is called No. And when I read that title, first of all, I'm on page 774, and I'm saying, Jack just got elected. There's not too many pages left. I just read, 800 pages. Where the hell's... And then it dawned on me, only a few months later, he's incapacitated. So there really is no life. I mean, there's life around him, and he reacts... And when I read the chapter title, I said, oh, that must be what he says when he finds out Jack is killed. I don't know if you quote him. I don't know if you say he verbalized anything in reacting to Jack's death. But could you tell us about his last few years? And the way you end the book, and we all know how it ends. It's so bare and abrupt. You almost want to say, wow. I mean, it's awful. Rose has to go up, you know, three pages toward the end, and just the picture of LBJ talking to an incapacitated Joseph Kennedy, just to, you know, console him. I mean, it just, God knows what was going through his mind. But the saddest thing was me as a reader picturing Rose Kennedy having to go up in 1968 to tell Joe that Robert was killed. I mean, it's breathtaking how sad this is. You just talk about family, talk about him in that period, talk about what you think may have been going on in him. We'll never know. When, in the period of his life, when all he could say was no. Yeah.
The only thing that brought a smile to his face, and it did bring a smile to his face, was his children and his grandchildren. I mean, it's unspeakable what he went through. And what's also extraordinary is the fact that there remains this will to live. I mean, the last rites were performed right after his stroke. Nobody thought he was going to live. Maybe a couple of months, maybe a year. But he just kept on. He had this, you know, this will to keep on. He knew he wasn't going to get any better, but he took joy, I think great joy, in his children's success. And it was Bobby's death that killed him. Here's a man who spends his entire life putting everything he has into the future of his children. And to lose effectively his five oldest children. I mean, if you count Rosemary, who is in an institution, right, unable to speak like her father, unable to walk like her father, and then Kick and Joe Jr. and Jack and Bobby killed, two of them incinerated in airplanes, two of them killed by assassins' bullets.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you keep on? And yet he did.
Just one last question. What's one or two things you learned in doing this? I learned a tremendous amount reading it. What did you learn? Some things that stick out in your mind, whether it's something historical or something about a human being. You know, as we began with Priam, I mean, as you talk about Robert's death, it's almost like Priam looking at Hector being dragged around the walls of Troy. You know, is there something about humanity or Americans or Joe Kennedy or, you know, history that one thing that sticks out that...
One thing that sticks out is the distance we've traveled in the last half century from being a nation divided into ethnic tribes. I mean, it is remarkable if someone had told anybody alive in 1960 that 50 years later, three of the four candidates for national office would not be Protestants, and the fourth would be an African, you know, would have an African father and a hippie atheist mother. I mean, it's just unimaginable. That's number one. Number two, I guess, as a Jew, non-observant, non-religious Jew, but very much a New York Jew, the degree of and the depth of anti-Semitism in this country, through and in Washington, through the 40s and the early 50s, was just extraordinary. Number three, I learned, again, as I do every time I do a biography, about how complicated human beings are, immensely complicated, and that as a historian, I've got to put my judgments in abeyance that no one can make judgments about good and evil and saints and sinners, about individual lives, because there are so many contradictions in each individual life, that Kennedy is this remarkable father and this dreadful husband, this extraordinary patriot and citizen who is the extreme egotist, but who raises his children to give something back. And then I also learned a lot about, I think, Catholicism, because in the end, Kennedy's legacy is a legacy of service. And what distinguishes this political dynasty, this political family from all the others, is that legacy of service. And I don't think that's separable from a certain Catholic mission, that those who have much have a response. All religions tithe and all religions believe in charity. But I can't imagine a non-Catholic dynasty or a non-Catholic Kennedy leaving two generations, three generations, with this sense that what's more important than anything else is public service. I mean, you look at his kids and you look at his grandchildren, and there is something remarkable there, whether they go into politics or whether they go into some other form of service. There's this sense that they're being privileged with grace and good looks and glamour and money means that they have to contribute something to the greater good.
Do you think suffering and loss contributes to that as well? And, you know, the cross is the heart of Christianity. There's the resurrection, but I mean, people identify. Suffering seems to highlight what is most meaningful. And when suffering occurs, it seems like maybe a more meaningful life would be a life of service.
Have you seen the documentary about Ethel Kennedy?
Yes, okay. I have. That's okay. Excellent.
In which Rory says of her father that when Jack is killed, Bobby, instead of compartmentalizing his grief, his mourning, instead of putting it aside or making believe it's not there, embraces it, embraces that sorrow, that grief, that mourning. It's who he is for a period of time. And he comes out of it, you know, a different human being. Joe Kennedy always talked about he wished he had the kind of faith his wife had, who could just move on after these tragedies. He couldn't. I think to some extent, you're right. I think to some extent, this, you know, I talk about this Irish, maybe it's Catholic, black humor. At the end of every rainbow is another storm, you know. And you can't and shouldn't enjoy that rainbow fully because you don't know what's coming next. And I think that defines the Kennedys in many ways, too.
Professor, this has been a wonderful talk. Thank you for your generosity in giving us your time today. America Magazine, America Book Club appreciates your book, recommend it highly. I've learned a great deal from our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.